Thank you very much for coming. This is wonderful, especially to see this turn out in week three, which I think is the new week five, really, in terms of like stress and tiredness. This is, as I'm sure many of you know, the first official event of the Reimagining Performance Network. Saul's and I are both co-conveners, as is Kirsten, and I think some of the others floating about here. Reimagining Performance is a torch network, and essentially it's a sort of virtual and literal gathering space for people who are interested in theatre and performance, whether that's at the scholarly end, or the practitioner end, or somewhere in that point in between. Because, you know, we're here in this university, we do have a theatre performance department, but there's so many of you doing fascinating theatre and performance work. So the idea is that it's a space to allow us to enter into interesting conversations, hopefully with scholars and practitioners, drawing together that knowledge to students. If you're not on our mailing list, you're more than welcome to give me your email address at the end, but I'm presuming if you're here, that's probably how you've come to us. I'm Dr. Hannah Simpson, this is Dr. Saul Eltis, and we'll be in conversation with Breach Theatre tonight. And to give a rough idea of what the event is going to look like, we are going to show you throughout the conversation some clips of It's True. Again, I know that a lot of you have already seen it, but for those of you who haven't, or just to call attention to some really interesting points that we want to talk about, content warning, absolutely prolonged discussion of sexual assault, sexual harassment. We'll then be in conversation with Billy and Ellis, but at the end there'll be a space for audience Q&A, so do absolutely have your questions ready, and we will try and be very disciplined and make sure that we leave you space for that. Absolutely delighted to have Breach Theatre here today, really, really astonishing contemporary company. I'm going to let Billy and Ellis introduce themselves and their company, because it's probably a bit less awkward for all of us if we just hear it from them. But thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Billy. I'm the director and co-writer of It's True.
Oh, hi, I'm Ellis. I'm one of the performers and also the co-writer of It's True.
And our company, Breach, is Ellis, me, and one other core company member called Dorothy. And we make primarily documentary-ish theatre. So we tend not to say documentary theatre because a lot of the way that we work will incorporate a devising process alongside documentary materials, whether that's a verbatim transcript or kind of other stuff that we're drawing on. And we tend to look for stories from either the recent or quite distant past that have something to say about, you know, the times we're living in now. So occasionally our work is a bit more contemporary, but definitely with this show we were looking to find something historical that was speaking to present moment, I guess.
Anything else?
I think we're always interested in playing with truth and dealing with quite serious issues, but also trying to use humour. I think that would be something I would add, but that's just a small thing on top of, yeah, still a very good decision.
Thank you. So do you want to let the next clip speak for itself, or would you like to do a, what is this, it's true, for those who haven't had the joy of watching it?
Yeah, sure. So for those who haven't seen it, it's true, is a verbatim-ish courtroom drama drawing on the court trial of Agostino Tassi in 1612, who was a Renaissance painter accused of raping a young female artist called Artemisia Gentileschi. So the show is an all-female three-hander that takes those court transcripts from a 400-year-old rape trial and kind of devises around them to restage it for
I don't know what our first clip is, so I don't think I've got a good introduction for it.
I have it marked as It's True, opening.
So this...
So this is essentially just to give you a sense of, like, at its opening, what this thing looks like on the stage.
Oh, that works well.
It might be down if you click on the cone at the bottom.
Rome, 1612, a courtroom. The questions are asked in Latin and the answers given in Italian. Each testimony of the 7-month trial is written down, but not all of the pages survive. What remains? is translated into English and now will be spoken again. Everything that follows is true.
This material to start with?
Yeah, sure. So I think I first heard of Artemisia through, there was a exhibition at the National Gallery a few years ago called Beyond Caravaggio, which is sort of about Caravaggio's followers. And there was one painting there which was Gentileschi. There was an interesting article just kind of about her talking about how Judith Beheading Holofernes, which I'm sure many of you will know is a kind of iconic stabbing painting that we end up with. It was an interesting article about how that painting has often been read autobiographically because the artist had been the subject of this kind of infamous trial and whether that was a fair assessment or not, whether it was autobiographical or painting. And within that article it said that the court transcript still existed and that she had said in the trial the words, "It is true, it is true, it is true," while under torture, all of which is obviously really shocking and awful. And we, as I said, often are working in a kind of verbatim-ish way. This is kind of at the beginning of the sort of It's True, the Me Too kind of moment or movement. So we're having conversations around that, and then Ellis at the same time was interested in making an all-female show. So we kind of meshed those two ideas together. Early on, I think we were quite clear, weren't we, that it was, had to be all-female. And we were interested in doing something quite stylized with it. So I think the idea of it being all female and done in quite a heightened way is quite intrinsic to that beginning conception of it as well.
Great. So can I ask you about the script? So am I right, it was a 7-month trial and the play is an hour and a half, maybe an hour and 20? So
I think it got longer, actually, every time we did it.
That's also the song at the end.
Yeah.
So there's a... So, you know, you say verbatim-ish. Tell us about the process of putting a script together from 7 months' worth of trial transcripts.
Yeah, so when we started the process by, first we had to find the transcripts, which actually were quite easy to find in the end. They'd been translated in the 80s by an art historian called Mary Garrett, and they were at the back of her book. So we found those, and our first process was just to read through them all, and I think, how many pages was it? It was sort of 80 pages.
Yeah, so it's not complete, definitely.
Yeah, it's not complete. There are holes in the pages, but it was still quite a lot, and actually a lot of it felt quite dry, and there were loads of characters or people that you hear from for sort of half a page who were interrogated, and, you know, it's a question of structure of a play as well as finances. We knew that it was going to have to be a three-hander, maybe four at a push, and we couldn't have sort of a cast of 60, which was all the people that was in it. So we went through and we made a list of the characters that we thought were the most interesting and the most intrinsic to the story, which in our case was Artemisia, Tizia, who lived in the house, and Agostino Tassi. and we found their sections, and we basically took, this is where we start lying, we took some information that other characters said and we incorporated them. So there is a structure in the show where Tizia has, we call it Tizia's turn, or Tizia's turn to good, where she has this moment where she sort of says that Agostino and Tess came to the house. That was actually said by someone else, but who did have quite a similar turn to Tizia. So we merged those characters.
You did a David Hare.
We
smashed things.
We did. You know what? We said it's our painting and we're going to put it in. Yeah, so we had to do that kind of to make it make sense, really. But that was a really, really early decision that we were going to start. I can't stop saying lying. We're not lying.
Well, it's what it's lots of them call editing.
Editing. Editing is the one.
It's a bit of creative editing, maybe.
Yeah, but we started, though, by putting all the information together that we thought was interesting into what we called our devisors toolkit, which is what we gave to the devisors when we started working with them. And at that point, all the information would still led to a show that was 3.5 hours long. And slowly, we just started pulling it back and back and back. And then, you know, we took this idea of holes in the pages, the fact that these transcripts don't exist in full, healthy states, as an invitation to sort of read between those lines and fill in those holes, which is where we sort of started using some devising, and we allowed modern voices to come through and change some of the language. I think what's interesting for us, or what was interesting, is that even though these transcripts exist in a sort of verbatim form, the questions were originally asked in Latin, the answers given in Italian. We were reading an English translation, so already that idea, it had been interpreted once already, so we were then putting another interpretation on top of it. So even though we're saying it's verbatim, we kind of knew that was already flawed, because who knows?
Yeah. Anything to add to that?
Just that I think, it, you know, the form of the show and the approach almost came about by accident, I think, in that initially you thought, okay, verbatim courtroom drama, do it like, you know, one of the tribunal plays, just kind of edit it down and stage it, and that's a comment in itself. And then when we actually read it, and as Ellis said, it's kind of half testimonies and square brackets saying text missing here and characters you hear from disappear, we were like, actually, we're going to have to do something, you know, much more interesting in the end. So I think, like Ellis was saying as well, about the small cast also being about finances, just we're a small-scale touring company, those, you know, kind of pragmatic decisions you have to make, I think actually lend themselves to quite creative approaches.
Can I ask about, you say we, and then you say the devisors. Explain who's we and who's the devisors.
Oh, I actually think it's all of us. Well, I mean, actually, in terms of the process of this show, it's interesting because there was a kind of traditional writing process that happened in between R&D periods where Billy and I, we have a very established way of working, which is that we'll have a Google Doc open and then we'll both just be on it sort of making edits as we go. We actually did have probably the equivalent amount of time in those writing processes where we were thinking of structure, how one thing led to another, making decisions about merging characters. But then, like I said, when we took those that information into the advising room, it was still 3.5 hours long, and that was just the verbatim stuff. So the devisors really did help shape it, and it was a very impulsive process actually of thinking, okay, we never see this and I would like to see this, so can we now think about how this is? Or we never hear Artemisia talk about her art, we only hear her talk about, you know, this thing that happened to her, so can we please imagine what she would say in that situation? So actually, even though in the process there was a sort of we as the company, it felt very we as the group that made this show as well. I think there were lots of different versions of authorship at play at once.
Hence, I suppose even on your published text, right, it's true by Breach Theatre. You flag up that dual authorship very clearly.
Yeah,
and I think that's always, I mean, that's what's exciting for us about making this kind of work, where it's like the show and the written text you end up with could only be created by that specific group of people at that time. It also does make it complicated, I guess, in terms of authorship, and in terms of, you know, with this as well, because we're working with original verbatim material, which actually we had to license the underlying rights to. It's then when we look at the text now, we kind of think, okay, what's verbatim, what isn't, who wrote what, and actually it's all so, you know, enmeshed together that kind of lose track of it.
Can I ask about the choice of a 1612 trial, which plays as very, very modern in lots of ways, I only know a certain amount of English law, not Italian law at that point, but I'm interested that Artemisia's father never turns up.
Mm.
That it's as though she's the one putting Tassie on trial. Was that the case? Or is it because it's certainly in English law at that point, if I remember rightly, the father could sue the seducer for damaging his goods. Is that?
That's effectively what happened, yeah. Mm. So Orazio, in the transcripts, it begins with his petition to the court, which is saying exactly that, you know, this man has raped my daughter and won't marry her, which really, when it comes down to it, was the issue. I think he was originally in the mix for us, but like you were saying, we sort of reduced it down to like, what are the simplest three kind of archetypes that can tell this story, and it is the accuser, the accused, and the person who's complicit. I think we kind of just thought, what's he doing here? I mean, as you said, historically, that would have been the case, and that's one of those moments in the show, or in the kind of concept of the show, that feels very, very different to now, where this actually is a rape trial, but it's more a trial about a woman's honour and the fact that he's not going through with the marriage that he promised at one point. So I guess that was us taking a bit of a license, kind of editing by omission to give it that modern feel that she was more in control, I guess.
Mm.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I also think you get all the things that you would get from Orazio standing up and saying, I'm bringing this petition because the damage to my property was such. You actually get that from Artemisia as well. You know, she says that. She says about, this has happened to me and he won't marry me. And actually, I think it's more powerful and more painful to hear about it within her world than, I don't know. I still think you get all the information without that father and without that sort of power structure there.
But it makes it a lot more modern.
Yeah.
And some of the bits that really lift out are the sort of sexual harassment, the harassment in the street, pressure. I mean,
yeah.
Is that in the devising, were those the moments that then sort of lifted out and you went, we have to go there? Were they moments you added?
No, they're there. They're in I think this is what we found so mind-blowing when we read through the transcripts for the first time, is how relatable they were. It doesn't feel like it's from 400 years ago. You know, Artemisia at one point, she obviously has her testimony about the rape itself, which is, you know, like Billy said, we were making it through when the Me Too stories were just breaking. And so, you know, we were hearing them everywhere. And then after that was the Kavanaugh trial. And it was almost like, I can't believe this is becoming more relevant every time. Like, that exists in its own world. But then there are more subtle, insidious little ways that sexual assault features, such as, you know, she says, I always say this, but she says, someone said to me I needed to sleep with them, and if I said no, they said they were just going to tell everyone that they did it anyway, that I'd done that. And I know people that happened to at school. Like, I know so many people that happened to at school. I even had a version of that happen to me at school, and it was like, that's 400 years ago. This is what we're talking about in, like, the 2010s. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. It's so relatable. It's depressing. But it meant that it is depressing. I can't believe I stood up at the beginning and was like, we like comedy. No, it's horrid how many things in it. It just hasn't changed. So it did speak for itself. And then I think, you know, there are sections that we left verbatim. We didn't change the wording. There were other things that we modernised. But I think when we've spoken about that before, it's actually surprised people about which bits we've left untouched. Yeah.
Can I ask about that? Because it's really interesting the way you do it, because I think sometimes with verbatim, when it, I don't know, things like, say, Robin Soames is talking to terrorists and so on, that there are some very recognisable characters in there, like Mo Mola, and you've got actors doubling and tripling and all the rest of it, and there's a sense in which it's going, this is true because it's the literal words, but this is an act, very obviously, doubling and everything gives you that sense of, this is also theatre, this is also complete pretense. So it's being honest about its own falsity. Interesting way. And can you tell me a bit about the courtroom scenes and, you know, choice to have women playing men and how far it becomes about that artificiality, the body language and everything else does, being about performance in all sorts of ways?
Yeah,
I think definitely we, I guess, have a scepticism of very traditional forms of verbatim that I think often sort of obscure the authorship or the editing that's happened and kind of present themselves, as you said, as, well, this is true because these words were said. And I think we wanted to draw attention in our version to the act of editing. That's why we have this introduction at the beginning of saying,
you know, these are the transcripts from this trial, a lot of the pages are missing, so the gaps are being filled in. Draw attention to the fact it's gone through a process of translation. And I think that's because for us, we are always interested in the idea that the way you tell a story, or even the fact that you're telling a story, I guess, is kind of as important as the story itself. I think in some of our previous shows, the way we've drawn those connections between the modern and the historical has been to kind of, you know, break character on stage or have a very meta theatrical kind of shape of the show. And in this one, I guess kind of as an exercise for ourselves, we're like, actually, we never want to break it, we want to be inside the drama, but we then need things that cut through that say this is contemporary. And I think one of the key ways that we do that is through music. So in the TV version, for rights reasons, it's all these kind of like library archival tracks that we picked that kind of sound a bit like what we use on stage, but we use a lot of like contemporary music, or music from kind of 20th century onwards. And obviously the costuming is very stylized, as you've said, even through the multi-role, you're drawing attention to like the act of performance. And I think that artifice for us is about, yeah, encouraging the audience to think about the contemporary parallels without kind of breaking character and saying, you know, we're doing this because, yeah, does that sound right?
Yeah, I think the only other thing I would add to it is, in terms of what you're saying about the all-female casting, we literally talked for about 5 seconds about the potential of it not being an all-female show, and then we were like, no. And I think the idea behind that is because power doesn't need to be like performed by, you know, in this particular story, a man does not need to perform Tassie and show him overpowering a woman. Like, power is the way you stand, is the way you hold yourself, is your ability to walk into the courtroom and take up the space, is the ability to break that and move. And I think we were interested in, one, the room being the safest room it could be, in the sense that I just think that, I'm not saying that it's only women who experience this, but there is like a shared level of understanding. You enter that conversation from a specific point. And that's how we felt like at the beginning of the show, that's what we were going to do. So it made it safe in that way. It also drew attention to, yeah, like the power structures and that artifice. But the amount of people who, you just buy into it. I don't think people watch, for example, Sophie, who's playing Tassie, I don't think people watch that show and think it's a woman playing a man. I think people really, you know, they get lost in like the power dynamic and how she holds herself, or, you know.
And we didn't really overthink that, did we, as well, in the devising? We didn't think, you know, where are you pitching your voice, how are you standing?
Yeah.
It was about playing the character rather than the gender. I think with both, there's been two actors who performed as Tassie, both are very, very different interpretations, but both times it's kind of just happened naturally and we haven't had to do a whole, am I a woman playing a man? Like, what does this mean? It's just kind of been what it is.
Yeah. They've also been completely different to each other, because Sophie, as her references, was using sort of, I think she sort of like tapped into like Boris Johnson and some Made in Chelsea actors. And then Haz, because when she came into it at a later, Haz, by the way, plays Judith in this, but she did a long stint as Tassie as well and was about one of our original advisors. You know, the Kavanagh trial had happened and she'd watched the Kavanagh trial and she grounded herself in that. And they both played the characters so differently, but it was toxic, both of them. And so many people just fell in love with them. It was so, so weird. I don't know what it is about toxic masculinity, but audiences can't get enough of it. It's really weird, and it's not really the takeaway of the show. But then,
you need some sort of relationship counselling on the way out. You.
Yeah. I know. People would come sort of sobbing, be like, I'm so moved, I really love the show. So your friend, like, okay, no, stop it. But yeah.
I mean, there is something. I mean, we some of the students here, we talked about this. I don't think anyone at least admitted in the classroom to falling in love with Sophie, but the sheer sort of hypnotic performance that she puts it in. I mean, it's terrifying. She's genuinely frightening.
Yeah, I mean, she is incredible as a performer, and she really did tap into the big, the small, like the loud, the quiet. She's, is incredible. But it was quite scary to play against her as well.
Yes. It was scary to play against.
Yeah, both of them were, but just in completely different ways. I mean, it's just the way they both look at you when you're on the stage. It was like, my friends. But I think when you allow yourself to like dress in that power and just take up those spaces, you can't help but interact with them in a very specific way, and it is very threatening, mm-hmm. even when it's not being outwardly and obviously so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think, yeah, sorry, that's a really waffly way of saying, yeah, just wearing power through gesture rather than, you know,
I'm thinking what's incredibly powerful in the performance, because you're so aware of that in the switch from I'm rubbish at doing it, but that kind that sense of owning a space, only, you know, expecting to be listened to, being able to pace your voice very slowly because you know everybody will wait.
Yeah, it was really interesting actually. We went and saw a production of It's True recently in France, and I don't speak French, so I couldn't understand a lot, but they did make, Tassie was played by a man, an older man, and it was really interesting having that process of watching the text, because obviously I knew what was happening, some bits were different, but watching it be played kind of literally in the casting, and I couldn't figure out how it felt, but I was watching and being like, this is not trying to shy away from the artifice in relation to this. I don't have anything to say about it, but it was really interesting.
Well, I think it confirmed our, because we've, yeah, there's been a few kind of other productions. I think it confirmed our idea that actually one of the conditions should be it is an all-female play. We're seeing a drama school doing it tomorrow that we're going to see, which we're very excited to see, by three female performers. And yeah, I'll be interested to see that as the only other production we've seen where the casting is more similar to how we've imagined it.
Yeah.
So it feels like it was built, as you were saying, around it being...
Well, we're very set on it being an all-female.
Does it give you a different ownership of the story, a different sense in which you are telling it, the ways in which makes it your story as a group of women?
I don't know. I mean, I would be interested if people feel like that when that condition has been put on them, of being like, do you feel an ownership over it from it being an all-female group? I think for us it did kind of give us ownership, and we were tapping in this kind of intellectual way of like, well, Artemisia paints all these women coming together and they're doing this, and it feels very playful, and there's a lot of solidarity between women, so that makes sense that would be the heart of what ours is. I don't know if the ownership comes through that, but I do think to say what I said before, it made it feel safer, I would say. And I don't know if that's fair, because we've never made the show without any other configuration. And like Billy said, it will always be the sum of the people that were in the room. But I think it allowed us to take ownership of the characters in a very safe way. And then we would take breaks and we would have tea and then we would come back. We went very low and very high in that rehearsal process, which is why I think there are moments where we're laughing and finding it very funny, and then moments where we really allow ourselves to go quite sad and quite dark, but it never felt unsafe, that show.
I might use that focus on, yeah, so,
do you want to talk about the next bit?
The next clip we're going to show is, we do not have the time to show the full clip, but it's one of the first moments where you stage a painting. And in this case, it's Susanna and the Elders, which again, I will let you explain, it'll be much clearer. But this is the moment after the staging when when Artemisia is explaining her version of Susanna and the Elders.
Artemisia, could you please clarify for the court what you believe to be the relevance of this painting to your case? What do you mean? Well, this is an iconic image, isn't it? Been painted by many.
Okay, yes, but this isn't just about the story, is it? This is about how you paint it. What you make a painting say. I mean, mine's completely different to the others.
It looks pretty similar to me. Same bushes, same knockers, knocking against the same Grecian sheet.
Right, sorry, have you even seen any of the others?
I've seen Alessandro Lori's, yes, it's identical.
Oh, no, it isn't, no. Alessandro Lori, he has painted Susanna to be encouraging. Look at her face in my one. Look at the angle of her body. It's pointed away from the elders. It isn't inviting that gaze at all.
Right.
And it's turned away from the viewer, the presumably male viewer.
No, but
I mean, she's mute. No, she's naked. Isn't she? She's naked. Susanna, she is naked because that's what people are when they have baths. Look, the point is, in my painting, you can clearly see that she doesn't welcome any of this. And I painted that because I knew how that felt. to be a woman who was being watched rather than a man who was getting off on it. Alessandra Lawry, I'm sorry, but if we're being really honest about his Susanna, she is quite clearly just more like, hey, I'm going for a bath in my garden. See, I'd like to do that outside because I'd hate for anyone to see me. What am I going to do down here, huh? Huh? I'm going to wash my hair. Oh, hi, you boys. Stop watching me.
Like me, the paintings that are being referenced there as well. Slowly.
Can you tell us just a little bit about this? I mean, first of all, I suppose just the decision to stage, and I'm already caveating that word in terms of how you stage these paintings as part of the performance itself. How did that come about?
I think we were really clear early on that we wanted to incorporate them. I guess in a kind of basic staging way, because it's an interesting texture to add. You know, you've got text and images serving as the kind of inspirations for this. We liked the idea of having almost two worlds within the show where there's this kind of factual, historical mode of performance that comes through the verbatim stuff, but then the paintings being just kind of otherworldly, so bright and so, you know, fantastical. So I think on a basic kind of staging level, it was exciting to have that layer to play with. But we were also interested in this question of how, at certain points in her life, the paintings seem to, if not be completely autobiographical, then to be expressing something similar to what she experienced and how we might weave those things together. The moment where we bring this in is just after Artemisia's talking about being pursued by two men. And we know that she painted her first Susanna around this time. So it's not necessarily autobiographical, but the things she's talking about are a dynamic she's familiar with. And definitely she is subverting, as you can see, like the traditional way that it's depicted. Of she's not inviting, she's turning away, and she hasn't got this kind of, she's not sort of dressed like that one. So we're interested in setting up that contrast between the two. And I guess in doing on stage what she's doing in the painting. So having Ellis as the performer, naked rather than nude, and kind of talking about her, presenting herself in that way, I guess. Mm. Anything else on that? Are you just laughing at the
film story? It's quite, I can ask about the dynamics of actually performing that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's often nudity is framed as a powerful thing. But that whole thing about you said, you know, where it says the presumably male viewer, it's an audience. How far are you able, you know, how far does it feel like a powerful act? How far does it feel other? Can you talk through? And
yeah.
Obviously, I mean, there's another whole dynamic where you have to sit here with yourself naked on
stage.
Yeah,
this doesn't feel great.
Sorry.
No. As in, no, you did ask me and it was fine. It does feel fine. I think... in terms of this moment in the show, it does feel like a powerful move, I think. Basically, Billy and I remember, had a conversation in when we used to live together, and it was before we started making the show. And Billy had said, this is before we cast it, you know, I think there's a question about the performer who plays Artemisia, we should ask them if they feel comfortable taking off their clothes, because nudity feels really integral to her work. And I was like, yeah, that wouldn't be gratuitous. Like, the performer... obviously they have to be comfortable with it, but that really makes sense. And then we cast it, and then it was...
Is there a moment where you got...
Yeah, the first preview, because everywhere that we had tried to rehearse the show was basically a glorified greenhouse. So every time we got to this bit, I'd be like, and now's the moment that I'm going to take my shirt off, and then a lorry would sort of pull up, and I'd be like, and not today. But it meant that the first time I did it was in a show setting with an audience in. And
were you doing the tech? Or did you not do it in the tech?
No, I didn't do it in the tech.
It was a surprise for everyone.
It was a surprise for all. And Billy had said to me before the show started, you don't have to do it. You absolutely don't have to do it. And I think, I mean, you know what techs are like. Techs, everything goes through isolation and it all pauses. The first preview was the first time we ran something the whole way. And actually doing it, I was like, no, this makes sense. This is a power move. She's choosing to undress to show her art. And then you know, that's something we toy with later in the show of when she doesn't choose it and when that's taken away from you. But I never at this moment in the show felt shy about it or felt nervous because I felt like it was a power move for her. Now it's obviously interesting. I think it's the projector screen, which is, that'll be the thing that does it. But yeah, no, I do feel okay about it. It is a very weird, I think there is, if we're talking about it really bluntly, there is something very interesting about what it means to take your clothes off in a form that is recorded. You know, in a theatre, you do it, it exists in a void, you can never watch it back. That's what it is. When I did this, I had a phone call with someone who said, you know, just so you're aware, this is going to go on the BBC, you might be trolled, you might want to come off your social medias for a month. And I thought, that's so depressing, especially in relation to what this show is. But that happens still. And that was a conversation that people had to have with me. And I was so nervous about it, so nervous.
What did happen? Did you come off?
I did come off my social media, which didn't make no effect of anyone because I never posted on it anyway. I was just a lurker. But I did take myself off it just because, you know, I think if your brain is that way inclined anyway, that you're worried about what people are going to say, which I am. I'm not confident at all in that way. It is just a very, yeah. Why would you want to put yourself out there? So I absolutely believe in it in relation to the show, but in terms of the decision to do it, I only did it because it felt like the right thing to do in relation to the show, not because I feel like the world is sort of a comfortable place to do that in.
Does that mean there are different power dynamics within the theatre? That there's a sense, you're saying, in a sense, once it's up on screen and that's part of the world of social media, that the power balance shifts? And yeah. If this is about Artemisia, about in some ways controlling what's looked at, that making the image is in some ways controlling the gaze.
Yeah, I think.
Is there a way in theatre where you feel like you're able to do that in a way that clearly social media, it's.
I think so. I think you buy into. I think there's a contract between audience and performer where, okay, we're going to experience something for an hour. That's going to exist in this moment. You're going to leave, I'm going to leave, and then it's going to be over. And you expect, you know, it has actually happened once, but you expect that people won't take photos, you expect that people won't. Abuse your trust in that way, like you're sharing a story and then it will be done. I think the form of it, the record of it changes, like suddenly screenshots are a thing that can happen and, you know, the credits are there and people can find you, people who haven't actually shared anything with you, they've just watched something that you've done. And I think that for me was something that I became incredibly aware of. We've actually just shot a short film, our first short film, and that is, I'm counting that as like the first thing I've ever done for cameras, because this basically ran as a theatre show and we recorded it. And I'm having that same thing now where it's just such a different mindset if your experience is theatre, because it's such a temporal experience and then suddenly it's not anymore. It's something that exists forever or as long as the hard drive exists. And I just think that's really interesting, what that does to you psychologically, knowing that you've created something in that form. I hope that makes sense. I feel like that's quite waffly.
Can I ask about that, you know, sort of going back to the theatre audience itself? I mean, it feels like there are sort of two, if Tassie is constantly playing to the audience, right, it's always that little, like, yeah, you know what I mean, you know what I mean, you get that joke. If that is one of the really key moments where, at least for me, I'm aware of you gesturing to the audience, right, the presumably male audience. Mm. And then, which sadly I don't think we'll have time to show, but the it's true moment where you are. And my understanding, maybe this is wrong, where you're saying it is true, it is true, it is true, it is true. And it is to every member of the audience.
Yeah.
Can you give us a sense of how you figured out those dynamics of you and the audience?
Yeah. So the it's true. So I think the painting description, I remember you saying to me as a note and saying, that is where Artemisia's going to feel most comfortable. She's going to she's going to own her art. She's going to love talking about it. So if she's tired and weary in other moments, this is when she's really, you know, that's her arena and she gets to be the showman. The It's True section was a fluke. So that was also the same preview. We hadn't really figured out what to do in that section, but we knew I needed to get dressed and clear the stage. And
And that Sophie needed to change.
So it was just like,
goes on so long.
It was just like, get out there and fill the time. And again, it was a very impulsive process. So I felt like everyone trusted in me to make a decision. And what became incredibly apparent is that there was an audience and I wanted to talk to them. So I went through every audience member and said, it's true. And actually that became a really, really important moment of the play, because I think firstly, that's when we're about to change form when we leave the courtroom. But I never think of that as me playing Artemisia saying it's true. I think of that as myself as a performer sharing with the audience a reflection that this is true and it's happening now and this is what's going on, and we're not even trying to deny that this is true. There's no dramatic interest in being like, but maybe she's lying. And it is a moment of just collective recognition and sadness before we take that sadness and we move it into anger, because that is a more helpful feeling to leave the theatre with. That's how I think of that moment.
Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that's, yeah.
Okay.
Is there a sense of it as a bearing witness moment? I mean, I'm interested in how often that, so they said with Colour of Justice, for example, the one about the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, that at the end, there's a point where everybody stands within the play to, you know, bear witness, to remember him.
Mm-hmm.
And everything in the audience, like from the beginning, everything in the audience then stood as well. And there was that sense of all being in a room together, acknowledging something and giving it to your attention. Is there a sense in which that moment that you had that it's true is sort of doing maybe some of the same thing?
Yeah, I think so.
I think there's definitely something about, so the, yeah, in we did this on tour as well, we always light the audience at that point, which I guess on a very basic level means that you can see the audience and that we're acknowledging we're in a shared space, and that's the only time that happens. So I think there is something, you were talking about it being a shared experience, sharing a story together. I think that is a moment where we really, really want to draw attention to that. And it feels like, just thinking with you saying as well, that you kind of stop being Artemisia at that point and it's Ellis on stage, it feels like, probably because of the repetition, when you repeat something so many times, it almost loses its meaning. I think in this case, it's like you're repeating it so many times that it's losing its context and becomes almost about every woman who's had this experience or every person who's had this experience. The play kind of falls away in that moment.
Yeah.
How does that version of, you know, you, and I should have pushed you earlier in this, but this wonderful phrase, verbatim-ish, which I love, and you're going to have to write down so we can publish it to you, but how does that fit with that concept of truth that is so, so highlighted at the end there? How does that version of verbatim truth, verbatim-ish truth, and it is true fit together for you in this production?
I think like we're interested in, as I said before, like drawing attention to the act of restaging, to draw a kind of parallel. So we're wanting the audience to consider how they were watching something and to constantly switch the way that they're engaging with it. So at times something feels like it is, a historical fact being restaged. At times something is clearly anachronistic. And so you think, oh, actually, what am I seeing here? Just because, we're interested in that and in the idea that, that brings something to it. But I think, Ellis and I were saying this earlier, it feels like within the play, it's like everything can come into question apart from the truth of what Artemisia is saying. It's like there's only one certainty in the play, and that is that this has happened to her. But everything else, I feel like we're sort of trying to wrong-foot the audience in some way or kind of play with their expectations of what they're watching.
Yeah, I think that's as well through decisions of what we leave verbatim.
Mm.
So we leave Artemisia's testimony as verbatim. We have cut bits out of it, but we don't change the words, and the torture section is verbatim. And I think that's exactly as Billy's saying, just to let it speak for itself. In terms of that truth, we knew what we didn't want to interrogate. We watched, like, there's an awful French production about Artemisia. Have you seen it? Not a theatre production, sorry. A film. Yeah, there's a nod. They completely rewrite the narrative so that when she's tortured, she says, no, I love him. And he's like, please, stop it. And I can believe that, watching it, how much someone's narrative can be changed in that way. And I also don't even understand how you can do that within the context of what it's trying to say. So I think, yeah, we were very aware of what we wanted to keep true.
Yeah, like you said just now, like, there's no dramatic interest for us in being like, oh, but was it true in terms of what she's saying?
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like, yeah, that repetition of it is true, I think is also drawing attention, hopefully, to that as well, to the audience of like, yeah, what is it that I'm watching? How much of it is historically true? How much of it has been devised in response to the world that's happening outside of the theatre, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to say about that torture scene, but I think we probably need to throw it open to the audience. And maybe someone will ask about the gold pants for a second. But no, we are, of course, interested in all questions. Does anybody have anything they would like to begin with?
So we saw it in the North Wall, and it was so powerful, and we thought how brave you were as well, all of you, but particularly you. And we were really struck by the story, and we didn't know it was true. And this is just a comment, just a question. We went into the wine bar next door and looked up all the paintings, because what was so brilliant was how you incorporated those images into the drama. It was fantastic, and it really sparked an interest. And how did you select the scenes, I suppose is a question, that you were going to put in there, apart from that one?
I think we sort of had planned it out. So as Ellis was saying, we had a kind of writing process and a devising process that we kind of alternated between. And we knew that we were going to use a bit of the text about Artemisia being pursued by the two men. We were going to overlay that with the painting. And we knew that Judith was going to be in there because that's kind of the famous one, and that is could be read as her kind of great artistic catharsis, her revenge. I think what we wanted to play with was then how those paintings were kind of woven in. So the first time around, she kind of very much stages it, presents it, says, here is my painting, and this is why I did it. We kind of see it in the two ways. We're quite interested in breaking that for the second one, and in this idea of Judith appearing to her as this kind of guardian angel figure, almost like through the canvas. And I think there was that moment that actually the line came a few shows in where you say, now, I need you now, and Judith appears. And I think that was kind of you as a performer thinking, what does Artemisia need to come to her? It's not just Judith appears, but it's Artemisia just summons her as kind of the embodiment of her rage and her empowerment in that moment. So I think we dwindled it down to only those two paintings. Originally there are a few we're interested in. There's one called Self-Portrait as the Allegory of Painting, where she's painting in the mirror and she's kind of presenting herself as the artist and the subject. And there just wasn't really an interesting enough stage in that, so that didn't make it. We were going to have this one, The Bathing of Bathsheba, where she's kind of having her feet washed. That was the ending originally, wasn't it?
We did quite a few sort of rehearsal sessions where people wash my feet.
Yeah.
And we're like, we can't do this.
Yeah, we like the kind of ritualistic biblical foot washing, but then we just thought, this isn't doing
anything. Oh gosh, you.
So you said that kind of you wanted to create like anger, and that was a really productive thing to kind of create in audiences. But there's also stuff in kind of like especially like trauma in art and stuff about actually how it's anger doesn't necessarily get you places. People have been angry about stuff for a really long time, and actually like an emphasis in more like reparative stuff, love is helpful. And so I was wondering, is there a place for that in this kind of play? And do you want to create plays that are like that?
Yeah. Can I stand up?
Yeah.
Sorry, I just feel like I want to look at you.
Hey.
Do you want to stand up too so I'm not alone? Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I think the anger thing, when I was saying that was very specific probably to where I was at that moment in time. Like I said, we were making it through the Me Too stories, and I was so sad. Like, I think we all were, but I was so sad reading over and over again these stories, and I felt really helpless, and I didn't really know what to do with it. And I think it's just being, like, a theatre maker. I was like, well, I want to make something because I feel angry, but the anger isn't coming out because I just feel so sad about how much I'm reading.
So the anger is probably very selfish, and it probably was like, I need to move it into somewhere, and it gave me a reason to lash out. But I think something that we really tried to think about throughout the making of this show was care of the audience. Like, we were saying that literally from the first rehearsal, and we were like, okay, we don't want to, and hopefully we haven't done this, like, we don't want to, like, trigger people in the audience, we don't want to tap into, in an unsafe way, people who've had this experience. We made those decisions through Tassie and Artemisia. You know, we don't restage anything in relation to the rape or the assault. We actually try and keep touching to a bare minimum on the show anyway. So we're trying to, like, stay away from trauma as much as we can within this subject matter. And I think putting care and love, both for, like, the character and for the audience, that was kind of our in the thinking of the structure of the show. But selfishly, and I haven't read those things, because I think I'm just, anger for me felt like where I needed to end, because that period of time felt so heavy. Like, and I know we're having this with so many different things, but it's just heaviness. Like, I don't know, I just needed to shake it off, and that for me was anger. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think there's something else as well, in that I think the structure of the show ends in that place and takes you to a place of anger, but then there's something that happens between the performers on stage that is more what you're sort of suggesting around, like, love and solidarity. You were talking earlier about how the song and the ending and the move away from the verbatim came through almost instinctively from the performers thinking, what do I need in this moment? And what we tried to do as well is, like, I guess with the anger being the, like, stabbing, beheading at the end, there's kind of a moment where she then lifts up the head, the lights and music come down, and it's sort of revealed to be a bit ridiculous that she's holding up his head. And then what comes out of that is the song and the, you know, this moment of shared solidarity between the performers on stage. So it feels like there's a tension there between, like, simplistically it is like a rape revenge fantasy, like, she kills him and she gets her revenge through her art. But I think there's something else happening underneath that through the performance.
Just something else I'll add to that as well. I think that's why, just remembering, we got some really, I don't mind saying this, bad feedback once, that we should have ended the show on the It's Trues, and I was like, no, awful. But I think that was also why we have that sort of epilogue where Artemisia gets to say, this happened, and it's really, like, it's an awful thing to have happened, but I went on and I did this, and I did this, and I did this, and I did this, and I did this. And actually, it feels weird that this whole show has existed as this restaging of a rape trial, but the end always feels, to me at least, as someone sharing it with the audience, and I think the audience felt this largely from the ways we would interact after the show. It kind of ends in a celebratory place. And I don't really know, like, how we got there, in the sense of, like, if that feels bigger than, if I started this, I wouldn't have imagined that's where we went. But I think that's what instinctive making and thinking about care of the audience, that's how it got us there. I hope that's okay as well.
So.
Okay, I'm
going to
sit down.
Should I sit as well?
Yes.
The play is really focused on being as realistic and truthful as possible with the verbatim and using the original script. But also, because it's a play, it's obviously a performance. There's a really big theatrical element to it with the performance of the actors, the music, the lighting. How do you balance being as truthful and correct as possible with that element of performance?
Ooh. I think we, so at the beginning, in the kind of prologue, someone says everything that follows is true, and I think we did that kind of as a bit of a joke, or as a bit of a playing with your expectation of what you're going to see. So I think there's something about setting out the beginning of the show of saying we're going to follow this as, like you're saying, as kind of strictly truthfully as possible, but then it kind of unravelling into something much more weird and theatrical than that. And I guess what I hope we manage to do is keep a kind of emotional truth at the centre of it while moving away from the actual historical truth along the way. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah.
Hi. I've always noticed that when you do the It's True bit, you say it is true, and the title is It's True, It's True, It's True. And it's just, like, always something I've wondered about. Is that a stylistic thing? Is there meaning to that? Or is it literally just, like, fitting the words on the page?
Do you know what? Yeah.
We have talked about it before.
It sounds a bit more contemporary, I guess, it's true. Yeah. But maybe It Is True would have been a stronger title.
Honestly, I remember having a conversation where you were like, you keep saying It Is True, and I was like...
Oh, were you meant to say It's True?
Or one or the other. I can't remember, we were like, it's weird that the title's the other way. Yeah. And then I think you were like, no, but that's interesting in relation to True. There's a punctuation part there. So, yeah. But I don't really know. I can't actually remember what it says in the original transcripts.
Yeah, because it felt like something, was it something about like translation or like time or something like that. I sort of love that.
Do I say it is true?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm holding my stage time. Yeah. Also, Sophie needs to change.
An extra syllable.
Yeah. I think also there is something actually though about the way it hits. And also, like Billy said, after a while, it starts to not feel like words anymore, and actually it is true rather than it's true, it gives you just something else to hit. Like, I just think it came, that's how it came off the tongue, but then I probably paraphrase and change loads of lines. I can't use that as a defense, so yes.
I was wondering about like that, the filming of it, because I noticed, I watched it like through the film, that like there was a lot of acknowledging of the camera, whereas I've seen like filmed theatre performances before where it's very like the camera soaring above the audience and like trying to basically be invisible, whereas I think all three of the actors were really, really acknowledging it. So I just wanted to ask like how that decision was made. And also, if you want to talk about the gold paint, I would love to hear it.
Cool. In terms of the camera, we made the decision basically, so we had five cameras. It was shot all the way through like a play, but like five cameras that were then live edited going between shots. So, but we basically said to actors, we worked with a film director on it, we basically said to the actors, treat every camera like a member of the audience, and when you want to address an audience member. So we had 12 audience members who were like a jury in the film version. When you want to address an audience member, you can choose to address the camera or the audience. And then obviously there were multiple takes, so we just cut in a few looks to camera. There's another moment where we use the camera as the painting, where you're looking at it. And I think really it was about trying to capture that live experience of being the audience. The show has so much direct address, the audience is being cast either as a jury or as onlookers in the courtroom, that we just felt like it would be quite weird if the eye line was never like down the barrel. The gold paint, yeah, what's the question? Just what is it? How did we do it? Why did we do it?
I mean,
So
I should maybe say for context, if you haven't seen it, it's the moment where it's thumb screw torture. Is it originally thumb screw torture, and instead of trying to stage that, you have dipped your hands in gold paint, and then it's the event photo that gives you a visual image that we've used.
So we came up with this idea during the R&D of how we represent the thumb screws, which aren't particularly theatrical. It's kind of lots of strings wrapped around fingers. And came up with this concept of a puppet paint, which then kind of spiraled into a wider kind of design concept where the courtroom is also an artist studio. And it just kind of worked. In the R&D, we had like a bucket of water that Ellis was doing that, kind of thought that's going to visually work. And then in terms of the colour, we kind of went back and forth between red, which felt quite literal, white, which sort of, I don't know, virginity or whatever white is doing, but that kind of just visually didn't work. And then the gold, we did a trip to Florence as part of the research for this, and most of the paintings have these horrible thick gold frames around them that are really distracting, so you can kind of see paintings. So the gold is kind of a reference to that, the wealth really of that time, and how the art was funded through these very rich kind of ruling families. It's also kind of inspired by, there's a show called Cock and Bull, don't know if anyone's seen, by an artist called Nick Green. And that was an all-female show of women, actually like we've lifted quite a bit stylistically, and it's women wearing like suits, and they have gold hands and gold mouths for the whole performance. And it's basically like political rhetoric and slogans like repeated again and again. It's like this performance art. But we just really loved the look of the gold hand against like the suit. I think it worked.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I always think of the gold paint as well as, you know, when you see statues of people, so sort of, yeah, when you see people trapped in time kind of representing an event or a moment that's happened to them and they're in gold and they're sort of there, I always think of that as sort of almost like people wanting to root Artemisia in this moment and this thing that happened to her, but then she washes it off and she moves past it. That's always how I sort of made sense of it in my head.
There's
that also feels quite literal, doesn't it? But
There's a thing by Jen Harvey, who's a theatre academic in the piece, about the show, and she talked about the paint being a kind of mark of shame that marks everything that Artemisia touches, which wasn't necessarily in my head, but I like that as an interpretation of being marked somehow by the torture and by the rape, and that being something that sort of sticks to her and goes on the rest of the set for the show. I mean, it was like a really stupid decision practically, because they're literally wearing these like suits the whole time, and as soon as you put on the like specially made period dresses, start pouring paint everywhere.
Yeah, thank you.
You've
got time for maybe one more question, and then we're...
I know I'm looking at you, but this person's had their hand up so often.
No, I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the audience. I suppose in terms of if you're trying to like impact the audience or leave them feeling impassioned or maybe even angry at the end of the show. I guess I wondered how much you guys in rehearsal had discussed like an ideal audience member or members, and whether you were kind of in some sense targeting the show, probably in between these things, but targeting the show at people who've experienced something that maybe is relatable to the show or survivors of sexual assault, etc., or whether it's actually more about kind of challenging people's views might be, you know, quite kind of theme or traditional, like, you know, to not caught up way. I guess I just wondered in terms of impact on the audience, whether you were aiming to change minds or aiming to kind of like give voice to something that hasn't been heard, or whether it was just probably could have voted
for. Yeah. I think when we were making it, we constantly checked in on, okay, if someone has experienced sexual assault or anything, like on a small scale or a large scale that relates to this production, how are they going to feel watching it? That was always like the first thing we thought of. I think in terms of like, there wasn't really like an ideal audience member, but I remember, I mean, I've just basically said this as well a second ago, so I'm sorry that I'm repeating myself, but the moment we were making it in was so specific in terms of all the news that we were reading. And we knew we didn't want to make a show that was about Me Too. We knew we wanted to make a show that was about Artemisia Dentileschi, but that it was, of course, going to exist in the context of Me Too, because that's the moment everyone was watching it in and hearing it in. And so I think it became about, I don't know, not confirming, but giving a space of reflection on the whole thing as well as the smaller thing, and finding some sort of solace and safety in that, in coming together and sharing a moment based on, I'm sorry, I'm really checking my words here, like getting some security from like sharing that moment as a community in a theatre space, and then knowing that you can move past these stories as well, because the way that the accounts were happening is obviously they're kind of frozen in time. They were about incidents, and then that was the end, and then there was another one, and then there's another one. Whereas we actually get to move past this one, and I think leave in a more hopeful position. So I think that was who my target audience was at the time. Now, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know, really. Something I was thinking is, Artemisia as a kind of painter, I feel like it's having like a lot more recognition now. So there's just been this exhibition at the National Gallery that anyone managed to get to. And there's, you know, a few things that we know of that are in development about her life. But at the time, like, there was no name recognition really, like Artemisia Gentileschi. So on a really basic level, I think we want to like bring this woman into like public consciousness. And like Ellis was saying, we were always really certain with ourselves that we weren't making a Me Too show, but we were making a show about one woman's specific story. And I think at that time we felt like we were trying to correct a historic wrong of this woman who was incredibly famous in her time being forgotten throughout art history. It's just about like, let's lift her up. And it feels like that's really changing in the last few years, which is great.
Thank you. On that note, we say an enormous thank you to you guys. That was
fascinating and wonderful. And thank you for the play as well.
Oh, thank you.